Hello, folks, and welcome back to another episode of The American Attic, where we deliver dialogue-driven explorations of California history and beyond. Presented by the Sacramento Historical Society and hosted by Eric Swigert, join us as we uncover topics that inspire imagination, inform action, and enrich the present. Our guest today is a man who has smelled the dusty archives of public history. He has watched as the sun set over the placid shores of the Pacific Ocean and on the edge of America itself, and he has deep roots in telling the story of California history. Prior to his current role as museum director of the California State Railroad Museum, he was chief museum interpreter at Hearst Castle, and before that, an intrepid scholar of public history. He has swam in Neptune's pool and has literally walked in the footsteps of other great California historians. And he continues to share his passion for the past to those who visit Old Sacramento State Historic Park. In this episode, we discuss his initial encounters with appreciating the past as a curious 16-year-old, the roles of mentors and teachers, as well as the unasked question facing public historians and more. So please enjoy this candid and compelling conversation with Museum Director Ty Smith. So again, I'm here with Ty Smith. Ty, thanks for taking time out of your day today to chat a little bit about what you're up to at the Sacramento Railroad Museum.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, I think before we get into the meat of the discussion, you know, would love to learn more about your background and your journey to history, kind of connecting the dots. I know after exploring your background, I know a lot of where you've been and what you've done kind of, it seems to span between the Sacramento area and the Central Coast of California. So how, in your own words, would you describe your journey to history as a profession and something that you're practicing week in and week out?
Yeah, I think I kind of always knew I'd be involved in history in some way. I was like 12 years old and I went into, you know, like we were latchkey kid, right? So like Gen X, here's your key and sure. Good luck. And so there's a lot of free time, you know, after school, walk home, and then a lot of free time to get into trouble too. I did, but I was in the house and sneaking through my dad's closet, which is taboo. You don't go into dad's closet.
Sure.
But I did. I'm unsupervised. And so I found something that was startling to me, and that was a military uniform. It's like, oh, this is odd. I know my dad wasn't in the military. You know, he was kind of a hippie and, you know, grew up in the late 60s and was in a garage band playing Creedence Clearwater Revival covers.
Sure. You know?
And I was like, oh, man, what is this? And I kind of looked at it and I reached inside the pocket and I felt like this silky thing inside. I pulled it out. It was this flag, you know, and I go, what is all of this? And so we had like most of a set of Encyclopedia Britannica. And luckily we had volume M. Mm-hmm. So I look up military, I think. And, you know, you kind of go down the rabbit hole of that. So I was looking for insignia, and In the span of that couple hours of that afternoon, I determined that whoever had this uniform served around in and around World War II into the Korean War and was a Navy medic. You know, so I was just kind of matching up all bits and pieces, paying history detective. And the flag that was inside was a Japanese flag.
Oh.
And so then, but then I had this kind of conundrum because I had to confront my dad about it, but then, you know, also revealing that I was in his closet, which I wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah, tread lightly.
Curiosity, you know, just got the better of me. I go, Dad, what is this military uniform that's in your closet? Why are you in my closet? Don't worry. Just what's the uniform? And so he told me that it belonged to his father, my grandfather, Clarence Smith. I never met him. He died when my dad was very young in Albuquerque, passed his military service. Mm-hmm. And so it just wasn't a part of the family lore. I think it was really painful for my dad to have lost his dad at such a young age in the way that it happened. He died of a massive heart attack in Albuquerque.
Sure.
But he told me, you know, through the process of that conversation, I just quizzed him and quizzed him and quizzed him. and kind of heard the story that I'd never heard before about my grandfather, who was a Navy medic. He grew up in Oklahoma, and the Army, you know, joining the military was a way out. And he ended up working as a Navy medic. He was at Pearl Harbor the day of the attack.
Wow. He was on
the USS Solis, a hospital ship. He witnessed all of the hospital ship horrors of that day, and then went on, served through the Korean War, and then retired. And that was his life. And so just through that object, you know, I knew at that moment that history wasn't something that happened in a book, something you read about in a textbook, but it is tied to things and objects and to place.
Yeah.
I think I understood from that very early time the power of all of that. And so I was interested in history, you know, even when I was running around getting in trouble in high school and stuff and kind of directionless, I was always reading about history and interested in history, even if I wasn't a good student. And so then it was like senior year of high school, and I go, well, what am I going to be? And when you're 16 years old and kind of a rebel and getting in trouble, it's almost cute. When you're 18, you're just a criminal, right? So you're like, oh, what am I going to do?
Things change. Yeah, things can change very quickly.
Yeah. And so I was kind of looking at the lay of the land. I go, well, I got to do something with my life. And I stumbled in my counselor's office, a guy I'd never talked to. And he goes, what are you doing here? What do you want? And I go, well, tell me about college. I think I might want to go to college. And he just started laughing. You know, just come on, Smith, get out of here. What do you really want? Don't waste my time. I go, no, I really want to go to college. He goes, well, have you taken any SAT exams? I go, what's that? And he goes, you applied to any schools? I go, you had to do that. And he goes, yeah. He goes, you should really take up a trade. It would be better for you. Maybe, what does your dad do? I go, well, he's a disabled Ford mechanic.
Yeah.
And, you know, broke his back wrenching on cars and, you know, all the stuff that he did in his life. And, and, you know, he told me one point very early on, you know, if you can, son, try to make a living from your neck up. And it's not that he didn't recognize the dignity of labor. You know, I came from a laboring family. And it wasn't that there wasn't dignity in that work, but it's just his comment was, they can't take that away from you, you know? And so kind of armed with that idea, you know, that was the, okay, what does college look like? But then the counselor says, you know, there's one place that has to take you. Like, where's that?
Yeah.
Community college.
Uh-huh.
And so then a couple Saturdays later, I was taking my entrance exam and I stumbled into Cuesta Community College. It was an experience that really shaped, was so pivotal in my life. And I met this guy named Dennis Judd, who was a public historian. He worked for a lot of years, giving tours at Hearst Castle, and was working as a, at that point, an adjunct professor at Cuesta. He would go on to be full-time tenured professor, but he just changed my life. The way he taught history was exactly the way that I understood it. It was through the objects and through place. It was rooted, you know, to things and places, you know, and he was the kind of professor where if we were talking about agrarian revolt, he'd say, okay, meet me downtown on Riverside Road, you know, 225 Riverside Road. We're going to talk about the Grange and the Farmers Alliance. And we'd be standing in front of the Grange building or the Farmers Alliance. So, you know, it was just that public like, historical approach where it wasn't these abstract things. It was like specific people did specific things at specific times in specific places and so rooted to our experiences and therefore so relevant, you know, to those around us. So that really did shape my desire to go to pursue history in a more serious way. The other choice I had was being a graphic designer and an illustrator, but I was afraid of being creative on demand. So I chose the history route, found some wonderful mentors, and kind of proclaimed my first semester at Cuesta Community College, which is, you know, community college is one of the great democratic institutions of our society. And I proclaimed loudly and vociferously that I wanted to be a professor and I was going to get a PhD in history. And that was maybe the most naive thing I had ever heard. I eventually did go on to do all of that, but it was a long and winding path that brought me in the meantime, because they won't just let you teach because you want to, you got to have all the paper, brought me into working in museums, which coming from working in auto parts, the idea that I could go up to Hearst Castle, give tours as a college job, it was nice to get paid to talk. Everybody had always told me to shut up to that point. So found my.
Sure. Well, I will not be saying that on this episode. So yeah, thank you for that. And it's now Cuesta College, is that right there off of Highway One? Right
it there? Is. Okay. Yeah, kind of in between San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was actually part of the first cohort to attend the North County campus, which really just a series of portable buildings. It's built up since then. But I grew up in Paso Robles, California.
Okay.
Yeah. As the locals call it. It's also, I grew up in a Latino community, and we'd be talking Spanglish, and but even they would say Paso Robles. You know, it's very precise pronunciation. Sometimes people correct me, and I go, "Yeah, I get what you're saying," but you know. Yeah. Locally.
beautiful part of California. And I wanted to just dial in really quickly. So Dennis Judd, you said, was a professor you had at Cuesta, and he really helped bring the past to life in a way that maybe other professors or other teachers don't really. Was he kind of the main instructor you encountered that kind of helped shape your interest in the subject?
Yeah, it was funny because I remember it like it was yesterday, 1996, attending his American history course. I think it was the 17B, so the second half of U.S. history.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it was a surreal experience because I graduated high school barely and then got into, you know, Cuesta College. But I was attending classes at the high school. So it was like going, you know, it was like, you know, going back to the high school campus. But I remember that a question came up in the classroom, and Dennis, you know, he had the answer, but he wanted to engage the students. Says, anybody, you know, have the answer for this? And my hand shot up, and it was about why Native Americans couldn't vote. And, you know, I understood that complex history of citizenship, you know, which didn't come about until the 1920s. And he goes, hey, at the end of it, he goes, hey, you seem like you're interested and know a lot about Native American history. Do you want to come to a conference with us? I go, what's a conference? And he goes, uh-huh. It's a place where people get together and talk about ideas. And I went,
sure.
Whoa. Yeah, I want to go to a conference. And so we all got in these two vans and we went up to Berkeley and we attended the California Indian Conference in 1996. I was 19 years old. And that evening, we all got together to talk about ideas, you know, like what we had heard in the conference. And there was this guy, and he was just sitting there off in the distance, and he was cursing and emoting and talking, weaving together all of these ideas. And I go, who's that?
Yeah.
And Dennis, he goes, oh, that's Dr. Bill Fairbanks. And he became my anthropology teacher at Cuesta College. Dr. Bill Fairbanks, another great mentor of mine. And between those two, they really, really mentored me, taught me not just the subject, but, you know, how to really, you know, what really was they taught me how to have a public life. And that wasn't something that was part of my tradition. I'm, you know, basically first generation college student. My grandfather actually did go to Cal Poly, but you know, this wasn't something that we talked about in my family. It wasn't something that there was an expectation of that for me. And so I just didn't have the vocabulary or the custom or the instruction of it. And so in addition to teaching me a lot about the subject matter, they taught me a lot about how it is to show up in public and have a public life and participate, not just in academic modes, but, you know, how that informs the world around us and community and all of those kinds of things. So. Best professors at Cuesta College at the time. Just amazing.
Yeah. And that seems like such a relevant topic these days too. Not just the subject matter specific historical phenomenon of Reconstruction to the 1920s, whatever the period you're focusing on, but how to have a public life. What do you think? This thought is just occurring to me right now, but what do you think if you bumped into any of those professors now? And you you shared your career with them. What do you think they'd say?
Oh, well, no, I keep in touch with them. I mean, they're dear friends.
Oh, great.
Bill Fairbanks, when he retired from Cuesta College, he was in his late 70s, maybe early 80s. He said, you know, there's no ritual. You know, he's an anthropologist. Yeah. There's no ritual, meaningful ritual in our lives for retirement. You know, so much of our life is our identity in life is tied to our profession. You know, you go to a meeting or you go to a party or something, and the first thing somebody asks you is, what do you do? As if that's the most meaningful measure of who you are.
Yeah.
But it is. I mean, it, you know, it's linked to that. And then all of a sudden you are, and then you are not.
Yeah.
And then what do we do with all that? We don't have any threshold or ritual moment. So he decided to create his own ritual, and that was to walk across the United States.
Wow.
And so he chose a route that was meaningful to him. He walked from Baywood Park, where he lived, and he went up to the Bennett Valley, where he grew up.
Uh-huh.
And then walked across the United States and ended in Dedham, Massachusetts. That's at the Fairbanks home that was built in the 1600s.
Holy cow.
But towards the end of that long, you know, multiple year project, because he didn't just do it all at once. You know, mm-hmm. he would pick up and go. And but he walked every bit of it. And we met him in Massachusetts. Dennis Judd and I flew out there and met him in New Hampshire, actually. Uh-huh. Flew into Boston. Met him in New Hampshire. And we walked a couple days with him. And he said that we slowed him down because we were only doing 12.5 miles a day, whereas in the past he had been doing over 16 miles a day.
Yeah.
And so we had a chance to walk. But, you know, I think metaphorically, I had always been walking with Bill.
Yeah. No, that's great. Well, if he made it that far, you guys probably were slowing him down if he was that far advanced in his journey.
Yeah, we were limping and feet hurting, and yeah, we were slowing him up. But it was a great time. So I keep in touch with all those people. They're, you know, dear friends and mentors, and we've worked on projects. I've served on boards, and, you know, continue to attend conferences with them, even when I wasn't part of Questa, you know, as a poly student, and then later a Sac State student, and then later as a UCSB student, I would always show up with the Questa folk.
Yeah. Well, and that's great, because that's one of the other benefits, not just learning about the past, but pursuing something like history as a academic pursuit or a professional pursuit. You meet some of the most interesting and compelling people that, and the relationships, you know, the relationships that come out of that. Just diving in a little bit more on your academic background, because I was curious about this, because I know you were, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were Questa College and also a bachelor's from Sac State. Do I have that right?
I did my AA and transfer work at Questa, and then I went to Cal Poly.
That's right. Okay.
And did my undergrad mainly at Cal Poly. I left before I graduated to take a promotion. I was a guide at Hearst Castle, and I came up to work as a guide supervisor at the California State Capitol Museum, knowing that I wanted to do my master's at Sac State, but not wanting to take advantage of that opportunity. So I left Cal Poly sort of needing to write a senior project, needing a few electives. So I actually took my last courses at Sac City College, a couple Spanish courses, and finished my senior project remotely and sort of just scraped by and then started the master's program soon after.
That's awesome. And then, but you ended up going back for the PhD. That was Santa Barbara?
Santa Barbara. I was, you know, it's a joint PhD program, or it can be, attending Sac State. And I had wonderful mentors at Sac State too, who said, you know, you should really go on and do a PhD. And I thought at that point I was thinking, well, you know, the master's degree is actually a terminal degree, and sort of had some success within California State Parks, and my career was going pretty well at that time. I had transferred to an interpreter position where I was working on distance learning, and I thought, well, maybe that's enough. You know, certainly no state job requires a PhD, and so mm-hmm. and then maybe that's not something to do. But I had really great mentors at Sac State. Says, no, you're going on. You're going to do the PhD and make peace with that. You know, they really pushed me in that direction. Yeah. And so I said, okay, here's the deal. I'm only going to apply to one place. There's only one place I really want to go. It was the creation, the place in which the idea of public history was created, Santa Barbara in the 1970s. And the idea at the time was that it's a joint PhD program, so I could do most of my coursework in Sacramento, go down to UCSB and kind of camp out for 9 months for an academic year, because you had to do a minimum. Uh-huh. At each campus, and then come back up and finish. But as it turned out, I was one of a couple, just a handful of public historian students who were offered some funding, but the funding was tied to the UC. And so that meant that I had to relocate fully to UCSB. Yeah. And so I did, and never came back to Sac State, although some Sac State faculty were on my committee, my dissertation committee, and weighed in on that. I basically did the whole thing at UCSB.
Wow. And we don't have to, we can get as much into the weeds as we want, but what, so some of these projects, like your this final dissertation, for example, what was the subject matter of that? Was it something, I imagine it was something pretty specific.
Well, I learned a little bit too late that, if you really want to see the world as a historian, you got to pick some, like do some research project in France or South America or somewhere cool. But I'm a public historian and sort of a local historian by nature. So, I went as far away as the Special Collections Library at the Davidson Library at UCSB. I just walked across campus, going to the archives, and I wrote my dissertation as a preservation history, critical preservation history of Santa Barbara. The way in which, starting around the 1910s, 1920s, a very, very Western American town reinvented itself as a Spanish pueblo. And of course, it started, off with the mission history and all of that. But, the built landscape, if you were to walk through Santa Barbara around 1900, it looked like a very wet, except for the landscape, proximity to the beach and stuff like that. The built environment looked like a very Western town. A lot of Beaux-Arts buildings, a lot of brick, a lot of wood structures. Today we see it as a Spanish Shangri-La, but that's by invention, largely by invention. And so I was looking at tracking, how that historic, as a project of historic preservation, what were the mechanics of that? Who was involved and why? And as it turns out, to recreate Spanish Santa Barbara, they had to kick out all the brown people. And so looking at how the mechanisms of historic preservations create opportunities, but also disadvantage people because it's an exercise of power, like things are. So looking at that, I had a title for it, initially that I used, but then I was talking to this good friend of mine, Malcolm Margolin, who was the longtime editor of Heyday Books, and I had sent my manuscript in, I think for like the California Historical Society manuscript contest or something, and I didn't win, but Malcolm read it, and so that was a win for me. And he goes, yeah, he goes, whenever you go to Santa Barbara, it's just sort of the tyranny of the pleasant. And I went, oh, that's it.
There's the
So
line.
if I ever come back around to making the dissertation into a book, which I don't think I'll probably do, but if I ever do, that's the title, the tyranny of the pleasant.
That's a great title. I have a close friend who lives in Los Osos, but I don't make it down to Santa Barbara as much as I would like. So yeah, I'll have to go check that out. Just and to see, to walk through a space that, like, especially given your subjects that you've studied, looks very different than it did 100 years ago.
No, about 100 years ago, yeah, because they called it the Spanish program, and it's a weird when you're engaged in that kind of research because it's not to denigrate anything that anybody's done. I mean, people make the decisions they make, and they have reasons behind them, and there are a lot of true believers there, Pearl Chase among them, leading the charge, who really did believe that they could do what no other municipality had done, and was to create really the dream of the arts and crafts movement. Of creating a community in which art and beauty and society were all wrapped together, in a harmonious way. Other private communities had tried to do that and succeeded in certain ways, but Santa Barbara really is a, if you're looking at it from an economic property value, a place where people want to resort, it's a success story in so many ways. It also has everything that's good has its shadow side, and the mechanisms of historic preservation, if wielded the wrong way, like any tool can become a weapon, right? It's like whether it's just because of its blunt heft or how it's wielded, and it did disadvantage people. And so not losing track of that, not because I want to denigrate the decisions that were made in the past, but because we as preservationists working in the present and the future ought to be aware of all of the sides of historic preservation. It's always viewed as a value positive proposition, or at very least a value neutral one. It's never viewed as a negative thing. And there are negative aspects to historic preservation, as a tool.
Well, and that's the benefit of hindsight, right? If you're in the position where you look at the past, you're able to see the swing of the pendulum from here's the lead up to the event, and oh, we can now see what happened after the event that may not have been desired or whatever.
No, totally. And then also, you know, being able to distinguish between that which provides a little path that that somebody else has tread that makes our lives a little easier from the wagon rut.
Yeah. You know,
it's just stuck in a way that we don't want to be, and just having the wisdom to look at that. And, I think it's good to understand what happened to the Asian quarter of town, what happened to the Mexican-American legacy of that town, and how that was forced to the periphery.
Yeah,
during
absolutely.
That just looking at that evolution.
Sure. So zooming back out a little bit, zooming out of Santa Barbara, looking at the swing of that career. So 90s, the rubber is really starting to meet the road, it sounds like, in the 90s in terms of career experience, to what you're doing now at the Railroad Museum. I did want to ask, you mentioned a few already, but is there a particular moment or a particular place that stands out? You already mentioned the significance of places when teaching history and how powerful that can be. Do you have any places that you found yourself across that career that really kind of struck you?
Yeah, I do tend to gravitate around the same areas because, I bopped up to Sacramento and worked, and then I went back down to the Central Coast and then came back up and then went back down. I've worked at Hearst Castle twice in my career. I started there as a guide trainee, seasonal employee, and then went back and worked as the chief of interpretation. I ran the tour program there and supervised the activities of a bunch of guide supervisors, and at that time about 70 or 75 highly skilled interpretive guides. 800,000 people a year or so were coming through that place during the 5.5 years that I was there, and did a lot of meaningful preservation work. I loved the place. That's special to me. It was in my backyard, but it was an amazing convergence of a lot of different histories.
Well, maybe
California history changes, but it's not the kind of, it's an additive change. It's an additional thing. And so you could really see on the landscape, you know, all of the eras of California, from Native American land use practices that go back thousands of years to the continuity of cattle ranching from the Mexican period into the American period. The mission influence, because it was all part of the hinterlands of the mission, the Asistencia and the cattle ranching operation of missions, and took its form because of that history.
Yeah.
And people like Julia Morgan understanding that history and incorporating that into the landscape. So I love that place, but I also love Sacramento. I've worked at the California State Capitol Museum, came back to run the California State Railroad Museum, not because I was a big train person, but I understood the centrality of railroading in our lives. And in fact, one of the first things that we did when we all got here, the management team that's here now, all came about the same time, within weeks of each other. And we really decided that to get more people interested in the place, is we couldn't just talk to the people who were interested in trains. We had to talk to them, but we had to talk to more people too. And so we kind of created a unifying theme that says our lives are made of railroad stories. And as it turns out, when you start talking about our language, you know, we're always getting off track, derailed, trying to gather up a head of steam, blowing off steam, you know, all that kind of stuff. It informs our language. It informs our music. I mean, you can't listen to jazz, rock and roll, country Western music without hearing the rhythm of the rail.
Yeah.
Our most iconic movies, decisions that somebody made 150 years ago shaped the way I get across town and my commute, you know, every day. And so when you start talking about it in those broader terms, it just comes bubbling up, you know.
Yeah.
It's just so much a part of what we are. So,
well, there's a lot to unpack. Now, a few things came to mind. I was scribbling some notes as you were speaking. So my experience with Hearst Castle, and you have an abundance of it, I rode my bicycle past it one time off of Highway 1. I was going south on Highway 1 on doing a bike tour, and I just looked up on the hill and I saw it right there, and I had heard about it. And I just, there's this degree of mystery for me personally around Hearst Castle. So I did want to follow up on you mentioned that it's a special place, and I just wanted to say why, you know, what makes it a special place? Are there?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not developed, and it very well could have been. I mean, one of the reasons that George Hearst wanted to buy it in the first place And he bought it at a time of great economic collapse for the kind of California culture. They were running cattle, middle 1860s, 150-year drought, catastrophic drought cycle.
Wow.
You know, the vestiges of the California culture who are running thousands of head of cattle. I mean, slaughter hundreds of thousands of cattle because the land just wouldn't support it anymore. And so therefore, somebody like George Hearst, who attained mineral wealth, was able to buy big swaths of it, you know, tens of thousands of acres and pretty cheap, you know, comparatively. And he was looking at it because he's like, well, this could be developed. It's got this natural advantage of the seaport that could be, you know, developed into something. San Simeon Bay, you know, harbor. Mm-hmm. That could be something. That rock up there, it's beautiful. It's cinnabar, but you know, from it we can get our hands on some mercury that's helpful in gold mining. And he owned, you know, a big portion of home state gold in South Dakota, Black Hills Gold.
Yeah.
So that was attractive. But then it was the family's love of it that also made them not do anything with it, you know, for years and years and years. And certainly by the time it got to William Randolph Hearst, there was no inclination to develop it, you know, in a major way. Corporation had some plans, but it was the grandson of William Randolph Hearst who ultimately led to what is one of the most amazing conservation easement plans that has happened in the state that sold off the development rights. So the corporation got some good money for it, but it means that it stays accessible in terms of the property west of Highway 1 for all of us. And then we won't see anything built on or in or around it, really, on the rest of the property, you know, like 50,000 acres. So it's a major triumph for conservation, open space. And in that respect, there's like still cattle on it and there's still cowboys, vaqueros, some with, you know, old California Mexican names who still run cattle on that land to this very day. So there's this great continuity of it. And so even if there wasn't the cat, you know, quote unquote, the castle on it, the land in and of itself is just tremendous. But then this amazing jewel of Hearst Castle, which is a testament not just to the wealth of William Randolph Hearst or his vision for having, you know, a beautiful place up there, but Julia Morgan's, the first female licensed architect in the state, her ability to take his sometimes very far out visions and then make them into a composed whole for our collective benefit. I mean, it's tremendous.
Yeah. No, I almost fell off my bicycle riding past there because I saw zebras, which I did not. I saw zebras about 200 yards off the road and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. And you know, there's other remnants of the herd animals that were part of what was once the largest private zoo in
Amazing.
The nation.
Amazing.
And, you know, sambar deer and oodads and zebra and all kinds of stuff, which, you know, kind of makes it all also remarkable and surprising. And you know, there's not a day that goes by, at least in the nice parts of year, where there's not people riding on Highway 1 on their bikes and some of them go and they turn and they try to ride up to it, you know. Sure. Like, you can't ride your bike, you know, up the mountain, sir, please don't do that.
I was definitely tempted. So on the property itself, and I promise we're getting to the Railroad Museum, we're on track to get there. Just asking about Hearst Castle itself. So I'm a layman, obviously. I've never been there, but I have seen it. Any places in particular that really struck you when you through your work there and your time spent there? Was there a particular spot on the property you really enjoyed?
Yeah, absolutely. You think it looks nice from the bottom looking up. You wind up that hill and it's 5 miles in and 1,600 feet up.
Wow.
So a lot of times you'd be up there and completely surrounded by fog. And you would just be the, you know, like in the full sunlight, but completely surrounded by fog. And then
so you were above the fog.
Usually. Got it. Yeah. Not always, but usually, but then when the fog would go away, would, you know, recede, just this commanding view, 360 degree view, the Santa Lucia Mountains, a view all the way to Point Junipero Serra, which is was once the northern boundary of the ranch. And if you followed that down, that's Fort Hunter Liggett.
Yeah,
the coast, just this commanding view of the coastline. And that's why, that's exactly why they went through the hardship of building that far up, was the view. And in fact, the guest houses, you know, we say this, but they're like 6,000 square feet and 4,000 square feet, you know, are named for their views. Casa del Monte, House of the Mountains, Casa del Sol, a view of the setting sun perfectly framed from the sitting room, Casa del Mar, House of the Ocean. So it is about the view. And yeah, I mean, you could, this commanding view, and then, you know, to see just the artful integration of the native landscape as it yields to a more formal landscape as it yield. And then when you're on the top, it's a very formal manicured kind of Renaissance garden. And to have all of that swirl together in that place is really amazing. So there's no bad place on the hilltop. And then occasionally, I don't think this was always true, and I think it may not be true still, but there was a little window of time when I was there when we got to have the employees swim.
No.
And so it's cold, let me tell you, but it's worth it to backstroke in the Neptune pool.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, I got to get up there. If there's one thing, you know, thought about, I've spent some time down there, like I was saying, but it's, I seem to can never spend enough time.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, no, I'm glad we got a chance to talk about Hearst Castle, because that's, it definitely seems like one of the gems of California in a lot of different ways. You know, there's Lake Tahoe, there's Fort Ross, you know, there's all of these places that you can go, but Hearst Castle seems to be on all of the lists of California I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a coincidence. Before we get to the Railroad Museum, last question I wanted to ask just about public history in general. As someone who's a practicing public historian, are there any kind of general opportunities in your mind, opportunities where we could do public history better, or things to consider in the arena of practicing public history, things that are maybe threatened currently? Any comments on that? You know, public history is something that's, it was never something I was practicing. I had a specific subject or a period of history that I was looking at, but any remarks on the state of public history, I guess you could refer to it as.
I think public historians, they dig deep, you know, into specific genres of history, areas of history. It's not that. It's just, they have to take the additional step of them making that history relevant to a group of non-experts or a very wide audience. You know, simple definition of public history is history that's produced for and consumed by a larger audience and a larger public. And so the challenge for public history is we have to speak the language of the people, not our own insular language. And I think that extends to genre. So, I mean, I remember going to school and just like Cal Poly, you studied under really remarkable professors, but really from a more intellectual, like East Coast intellectual, you know, history tradition. And they would complain about things like Ken Burns. Oh, I can't believe Ken Burns did this in his documentary about the Civil War. And he gave voice to this person and didn't do that. And you know, he used something as crass as a metaphor to make a point about compared something, you know, and I get it, because we need research historians. It's not that, but it's time for the historians to stop complaining about how the movies are made or complaining about the more popular forms of the graphic novel or podcasts or documentary and start doing those things themselves.
Yeah.
Because that is the language of the people. You know, most people don't pick up a book, maybe at all. Those who do probably pick up a historical fiction before they pick up a weighty, you know, historical tome. But there's ways that we could write history to make it more exciting and more accessible. And we only benefit, you know, history as a discipline. And then just sort of how that gives people. I mean, history, you know, history isn't just about the past. History lends clarity and meaning to our uncertain present and future. And it buoys us in a way that helps us deal with all of that coming at us. And so if we don't show up for the public, if we don't show up for a community as historians, whether we identify as public historians or not, then we are only strengthening the infirmity. In society, and the infirmity is disconnection. You know, that I heard the most profound thing I've ever heard anybody say, maybe, you know, that the root of all evil is not money or even the love of money, but the root of all evil is disconnection. And history is one tool that allows us to connect, not just to each other, but to something deeper. It's literally our roots, right? It roots us. But if we're disconnected from our roots, then there we are, just sort of tempest tossed by whatever's happening in the moment. So public historians have an obligation to show up in the world.
Yeah. Well said. And I feel like those words are very important these days, you know, so thank you for that. Changing gears a little bit, looking at public history, your background with it, how did that background prepare you for the role that you're now in with the Railroad Museum?
I think any success I've had professionally, I could trace back to my first season as being a guide at Hearst Castle as a guide trainee. And I was terrified. Because I didn't come from a household that had a public life. My parents didn't have a public life. They worked hard. But, you know, they didn't have that presence in community. And so I came out into the world ill-equipped to be a communicator, ill-equipped, you know, to be up and kind of having the focus.
Sure.
I guess I'd always craved it. That's why I was maybe a class clown and got into the kind of trouble that I did. I always wanted maybe a little bit of attention, but this allowed me, you know, that opportunity allowed me in a very constructive way to communicate and to have a presence and have a public life.
Yeah.
And it taught me the tools necessary to say what I mean, to be concise with language, to paint a picture, to move people. That skill as a guide, as an interpreter, talking to just random 54 people who come off of a bus from all these different backgrounds and be able to develop a skill where I could connect at least a little something to their heart and their personality, made all of the difference in the world and everything that I've done since, whether that's, working as a museum director, whether that's serving as an adjunct professor of history at Sac State, you know, all of that stems from, you know, being, I guess started when I was 23.
Yeah.
And just, you know, figuring out how to communicate with people. Because at the end of the day, you know, that kind of activity, I was talking to a group of docents here, you know, highly trained volunteers here at the Railroad Museum. And I said, here's the thing about the kind of work that we do. It exists at the intersection of two important ideas. And one of them is that the work we do is awfully important in terms of connecting people to something and giving them perspective to see their lives in a different way, maybe connecting them to deeper roots, all those high-minded things that I just talked about.
Uh-huh.
Same time, it's just talking to people.
Yeah.
So, you know, the intersection of those two ideas is just what it's all about. And people are people, you know, no matter what, no matter their background, no matter where they're from. So, you know, if it's managing a group of volunteers and wonderful staff like I have here at the Railroad Museum, that all comes through, or anything that I've done, you know, leading up to that. It's just really attributed to that very pivotal 1 year of being a guide trainee.
Sure. Yeah. And I think there's a theme here revealing itself, and just the relationships and the connections that can happen, you know, when you're working in a field like this. So wrapping up, I know we're coming close to the hour mark. What's going on at the museum these days? What can visitors expect, either seasoned visitors that have maybe taken a trip or two already, or newcomers and first timers?
Museum opened in 1981, and I came on 7 years ago. And I was, you know, I worked for California State Parks, and so the hiring process was, you know, fully a product of that state process. But there was a guy who was advising on my hiring panel. His name was Dr. Denny Ansbach. And he was the founder of the museum, one of the founders, and very pivotal. I mean, he was the one who sat on board the Gold Coast car that's now in the museum with then Governor Reagan and said, shouldn't there be something like a railroad museum?
Wow.
And it just started with that question. All of it just started with that question. But in the conversations that I had with him, which were frequent, he would always tell me, the things that made us successful for the last 40 years are not going to be the things that make us successful for the next 40 years. And so we always viewed it as a second founding. And I think we're in that process of the second founding of the museum. And so in that, we asked the question, how can we mean more to more people? Because the people who came in through the doors in 1981, they had a familiarity with just how much railroading and railroading culture intersects with our lives. They had experienced themselves the golden age of railroads. They had family members who are more closely related to them on their family trees who had worked for the railroads. It was a bigger part of our regional life back then, even if it was sort of in passing. And the fact that it's here at all represents some urgency around this transition in society. But now we have people coming to the museum and they're like, I don't like trains, or I do like trains. But that's not really the most meaningful distinction. And so we have to do more to answer the unasked question. And the unasked question is the same no matter if you're at Hearst Castle or at the California State Railroad Museum. And that's what's in it for me. Everybody, my former colleague, Vicky Kastner, who was a brilliant historian at Hearst Castle, she said, we all listen to the same radio station in our head, WIIFM. What's in it for me? That's the filter, you know?
And yeah.
So we have to, we can't just assume. We have to answer the unasked question. We can't just put the open sign up and do a pretty good job at welcoming whoever happens to come through the door. We have to run down the street and say, did you know this? Did you know that? What about this? And draw those neat connections. They exist, but we have to draw the connections that run from the past into the present and their futures. And so really, people look at us as a history museum, but we're not. Every day, the main thing that we do, the most important thing we do, is we help people imagine their futures through understanding their past and our collective past. So there's a lot more people stories in the museum than was the case before. Railroading is the most diverse history that we have in this nation. And so we do a lot more to draw out those experiences. We work with community to build exhibits like we did with the Chinese Railroad Worker Experience, where the exhibit wasn't just an expression of what we thought or, a synthesis of whatever the latest books were. It was really a demonstrably an expression of the Chinese Railroad Worker descendant community in concentric circles extending out from Sacramento, but to San Francisco and Seattle and Utah and all these other places that really represented what they wanted to see. So we are really working on kind of three main initiatives. And one of them is building a laboratory of learning. There's every day where we have young people, college students from community college to undergraduate to graduate students who are learning by doing. They're sorting collections, they're working on exhibits, they're getting their first experiences, some of their first experiences in working for their community at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
But we also teach classes, so sometimes the classroom isn't out at Sac State. Sometimes this is the classroom and we have graduate students who are creating exhibits such as the Farm to Fork, a public history exhibit here in the museum. Where when wherever that happened, the Sacramento stopped being the city of trees and started being the farm to fork capital of America. They wanted to go, well, what does that really mean? And so they did, this exhibit that gave deep roots to that concept. The other thing we try to do is understand we're a museum without walls. So people think of the museum, they think of the brick building at the edge of town, but really the museum's everywhere, right? It's like, what is this track doing on our street? What is that old railroad looking building over there? Right. I mean, the remnants are all around us. And so we're the hub of that and we're the place that can inform, that, but we need to connect the dots to, people's backyards and where they are.
Yeah.
And then also we run a train. I mean, read about history inside the museum. I'd like to think it's experiential. It's getting more experiential all the time, but then also go ride history. I mean, get on the train and go down the Walnut Grove branch line, or at least part of it, and understand how that led to a more lasting gold rush, the second California gold rush that's been going on since the 1880s.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is about community, not just being a place that people visit, but a place where people enjoy concerts. So you can come here and enjoy a candlelight concert. We don't put it on, but we're a venue for it.
Uh-huh.
But they get to see the museum in a different light. It's not just a place that you visit once when you're in fourth grade and then maybe come back if you have kids, but it should be a place that has activities and things that people can do and be involved in, not just passive, in a passive sense, but in an active sense, building a place where people can inscribe their own experiences, not just read a book on a wall.
For sure. But I think that will go a long way and continues to go a long way of what you were mentioning earlier about popularizing history and making it more accessible. So I think that, Ty, is a great place to wrap up. Just wanted to say again, thanks for your time. today. And thanks for all you do over there at the museum.
My pleasure. It's an awfully important place in our community here in Sacramento. I always say this, there are some places in the world that don't even have one weak connection to world history. And here we live in Sacramento, and our local history is world history. You know, uh-huh. The gold rush, the building of the first transcontinental railroad that connected the not just the nation, but the world in a way that it hadn't been before. And then all of this agricultural bounty and wealth. And so, you know, all we're ever trying to do with the museum, all I ever try to do with any history course I teach is just a genealogy of the present, a genealogy of how did we get here? And that strengthens, I think, everybody's sense of cohesion, identity, and connection more than just about anything can.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Sacramento Historical Society's The American Attic. If you'd like to learn more about the Society and upcoming speaker series, please visit sachistoricalsociety.org. If you have ideas for topics and speakers we can engage, drop us a line at admin@sachistoricalsociety.org. See you next time.